What is up? What is going on, everybody? This week, no one here has an epic mustache, but also no one here is wearing a red sash. So we don't look cool, but our lives are safe. We'll talk about it on the other side of the song. Welcome back, everyone, to another new episode of The Threequel. As always, I am one of your three co-hosts, Ethan Klein, here with me, Brad Miller.
What's up?
And Mike Duranik.
How's it going?
It is going well, and for you, it's going great, because we're doing your pick for the month of December, Tombstone, starring Kurt Russell, Val Kilmer, and, I mean, I could list everybody else that stars in the movie, but we'd probably be done recording by that time, because this movie is filled with quite the host of big stars. But we'll get into all those and plenty of other things as we talk about this Western, which is a genre we haven't done a ton of. I know we did 310 to Yuma. You know, some consider things like Wind River and Sicario modern Westerns, which I'd be okay labeling there. But
No Country for Old Men.
Right, but true to heart, you know, the olden day horseback, revolver, Western. Not a ton of those that we've done.
Mad Max, Fury Road, you know.
So we've done some, and we've done some postmodern Westerns.
Yes.
But I think your point still stands, Ian.
Yes. And, you know, while 310 to Yuma really, you know, leaned into the way that Westerns used to be made, you know, the old, the John Wayne, the Clint Eastwood Westerns, this is not that. While this is set in that, this is more Michael Bay's version of a Western. But nevertheless, we are here. We're going to talk about it. It's one that I, you know, you and I have talked about making sure it gets on the show at some point, and we were finally able to pull the trigger here. So let's get into it, guys. Tombstone, 1992 is the number that I want to say, but that almost sounds too old.
Yeah, it's a little newer than that. Let's see here. I've got it pulled up on the Wikipedia. 93. It's not too much.
93. Okay,
I would have placed it a couple years older than that. So.
Yeah, so 1993, and I'll ask you the question I always do, guys. How did you first come to see Tombstone? Was it in the theaters in 93? Did you catch it a little bit later? Spoiler alert, I did not see this one in theaters. This is one of the movies we've done that's older than I am. But where are you guys at with Tombstone, and then what did you bring into this rewatch?
I honestly don't remember. I think I saw this probably like I used to go down to the local library and get some free films to watch, and I probably picked it up there. Don't have a good recollection of it, but I knew exactly what it was, so I knew what, you know, what I brought into it. It was a Western that had good actors and may or may not be a good movie.
Fair. So yeah, for me, I don't remember exactly when I saw it for the first time, but I would venture a guess. I would venture a guess that it might have been when I went down to Texas to visit my uncle in probably like 1996. He is a huge fan of this movie, and I am as well. While this is well north of the Red Eye territory for me.
That's what I was going to ask next. Yes,
it makes your fascination with Red Eye look like the minor leagues by comparison. I will share that by far my most memorable time watching this movie is that this has the distinction of being the first movie that I watched as a father. I actually watched this in the hospital room the night that Andrew was born. It was on TV, and I popped it on, and I just have this vivid memory of laying there on one of those uncomfortable couches with him laying on my chest sleeping while my wife was laying in bed sleeping, and just thinking, you know what, this is pretty cool, being a dad and getting to lay here and watch this movie. And so if this movie was not already ironclad locked into my actual top 10, I don't have 43 favorite top 10 movies like Ethan does, that experience definitely knocked it home.
My story can't top that. You should have given me a little wink and a nod. I could have gone first, so that you could clean it up for us. I don't have an actual recollection of the very first time I saw it, much like you two, but leaning into that Red Eye territory, this is also a movie that I have seen well north of 20 times. This was, I mean, as a kid, I just know I saw it at some point as a kid. I know the first time I saw it was on TV, because I remember this being a movie that my mom and dad really, really liked, and kind of a weird thing, because usually my stories are, I was 5 years old and watched Gladiator. I know that this one was mom and dad were like, you can watch this, but only because it's on TBS. Right? Whatever distinction that this movie had, that for some reason this was the one I couldn't see unedited. But then I know that I remember one Christmas, my mom got my dad like the director's cut special edition box, which is how I watched it this time, because this was one of the times it wasn't streaming anywhere. And just watched it time and again as I grew up, and I've just always really enjoyed it. I grew up on Westerns, like we've talked about. I mean, John Wayne that was 90% of my viewing as a child, right? It was John Wayne movies. That was what I watched constantly. So I love them. This is certainly, I mean, I would say this is one of my five favorite Westerns, absolutely, for different reasons we'll get into. But yes, seen it a ton, have watched it, you know, for a large portion of my life. And now we get to talk about it here on the podcast. So let's get into it. Mike, it's going to be you versus me, even though now apparently I'm the biggest cheater in this game, for the Rotten Tomatoes game. But I will be going first because I did beat Brad last week, as we did Blood Diamond. And while I took one of my 10 favorite movies, I was able to gain a victory with that against Brad. Now you have the opportunity to be victorious against me. And I'm actually terrified that I get it head on. Like, I because you guys will just not let me hear the end of it.
This is the pressure.
Blind guess.
When you get called out as a cheater, right? Because, I mean, I understand this pressure that you're feeling. Brad has made a... kind of a cottage industry of trying to convince me that I was cheating, and I have often been like, man, I hope I don't get this right, because if so, then I have to hear it more. So I do understand. I mean, the difference, of course, being that you've admitted that you cheat. So this is
where I'm at with it. It's a coin toss. This movie is either rotten by the critics, or it's right in that, like, Avatar range, right? Like, there is no in-between. There's no way this is a 90. It's not going to just safely be fresh. It's either in the 80s or they hated it. And I could see critics going either way. I'm going to flip the coin that hopefully people understood what this movie was trying to be. And I'm going to say 85. Call it good and let you play the game.
That made it easy for me because, as you pointed out, there's no way that this thing is in the 90s. So I have to take the under, and I will just, like, I'll take the 84 and lead us in with the critics are wrong. Brad?
Well, you both tried so hard to prove that you weren't cheating that you were both pretty far off of the actual score, and it comes in at a 72. So I was completely wrong, north of that to try to get the scent off of the stuff that used to happen in the debauchery room.
You know, I love the fact that I get looped in with the cheating. Clearly, if you were going against him, you would have taken the 84 on the under.
Oh, yeah,
right?
For
like,
sure.
That's the only way to play this.
Absolutely.
But 72, all right.
So it is a 72, and that means the next question is Rotten Tomatoes correct or not? Mike, you say no. I say no. Brad, is it a clean sweep? Is Rotten Tomatoes correct? We'll let you start, since we are both obviously on no, it needs to be higher than 72. Is that where it is at?
So I'm going to say no, they aren't correct, but for different reasons than you guys. I think that
Brad
might be a little too high.
Oh my God. No way. It's The Rock all over again.
I think that, well, actually, okay, so let's get into this a little bit. Off air, in between episodes, I went upstairs to use Mike's bathroom, and while I was using the bathroom, I was sitting there thinking, is this The Rock all over again for Mike? Like, I was having this... this stream of thought, and I'm glad he shared the story that he did, because I understand now how this movie got locked into where it is in his pantheon of films. And I think if I had a film like that connected with me and my son, well, in this case, it would have been my daughter as my firstborn, it would mean a lot more. And Ethan also, I guess, having that Western background of growing up watching these types of films, it makes me feel better that I just don't connect with this as much, which is odd because I really wanted to. I thought this movie, when I watched it before, was better. And this rewatch just, it was not that good for me. And it's kind of sad because I really like some of the actors in this. And when Sam Elliott popped on the screen, like, I did a little fist pump because, like, I really like that guy. I will say one thing it had going for it is, I forget the actor's name. Let me look real quick. Stephen Lang didn't take a turkey baster up the keister in this one like he did in Don't Breathe. So we'll call that a victory.
Probably should have.
But I don't know. I found it a little corny. I found it very repetitive. They just kind of lost me in some of the stories. I think the stuff with him and his wife and her headaches and the medicine didn't get played out really well. There were some loose ends there. I think, too, like, I really wanted to like Wyatt Earp, and you want him to be this, like, stellar, ethical lawman, you know?
But he's an oak.
But he's essentially trying to, you know, take these people's money in different ways, and didn't want to get involved in some of the stuff, and was, yeah, chasing another lady throughout the whole film, even though he was pretending that he wasn't. So there were just a lot of things about him that were a little, his moral compass was a little off, and not that there's anything wrong with that. Humans are going to have flaws in that, but that's not the type of character I thought he was going to be playing that I wanted to see on the screen. So there are just a lot of things that just didn't connect well with me. So I was kind of being a little funny when I said it was rated too high. I think that I would have it right around that number, probably 70 is where I would have came in. So
did you say where the audience had it at when you told us?
I did not. I
just
didn't
pulled
even,
it up.
I didn't look
94% is where. So the audience.
Woo! The audience agrees with us, Brad.
Well, that does not sway me in any way.
Oddly enough, the audience, as much as they apparently loved it, didn't show that. This might be the biggest flop we've ever done. It claims that it's a budget of $25 million, which I think is impossible. This thing had to be more. That's always estimated. I guarantee this thing cost more than $25 million. It only made $55 million at the box office.
And the numbers I'm looking at are 25, but then 73.2. So
okay. So,
but regardless,
but 12 million of that was all the times that Mike went and watched it. So
right, and that's not marketing. Whenever you see a budget number, that has nothing to do with marketing.
Right,
and you always factor in, you know, a good amount for that.
So I mean, a couple of things to, you know, Brad, your critique. I think so. This film is very loosely based on the events that actually happened in Tombstone, but where it is not loosely...
The names are real.
Right. Well, where it's not loosely based is what you just talked about. Wyatt Earp in his real life, and I am fascinated by Earp and this entire time period. I've read a ton on it, a ton of histories. Earp himself was very much just trying to go get rich. That was all he cared about. He was not in a monogamous relationship with his then wife at the time that he went, ended up going and actually did get with Josie, right?
Josie, yeah. Whatever, yeah.
And ended up living with her. They moved up to Alaska. They went to California. So if anything, the way that Kurt Russell played the character actually gave him too much credit, probably. As having a moral center that Wyatt Earp, in reality, from what histories can tell us, did not have. But I think, again, for me, and we'll get into it, a pretty memorable performance, but he is definitely not the, like, gold star protagonist hero. And I think that's one of the things that the movie did well, was show that he was not clean by any means. He just happened to be at this place at this time. And, you know, as with everything in history, it's a lot more complicated than this. It wasn't as easy as, like, good guys, bad guys. Well, now we're going to go hunt down the bad guys. There was a lot more murky gray in the middle there.
Yeah. I mean, so, like I said with Blood Diamond, a movie that I have a lot of love for, like, I won't lie and say a movie's perfect when it's not. You said repetitiveness, and you said it's a theme that you had this month. I would cut Dana Delaney out of this movie. Josephine Mark. I don't need... And you're right. It is the historical accuracy of it. I think this movie does get better if we don't stop and pause with his opium-addicted wife and his side piece, right? Like, if this movie was just Doc Holliday and Wyatt Earp and the brothers in Tombstone, like, I don't care. I don't care that he ends up with Josephine at the end. That brings nothing to me. I get more touched by him saying goodbye to Doc than I do him finding Joe, right? Like, so that would be where we... I say trim the fat all the time. That's the fat I would trim, is the love story. Don't care. Not why I hit play on this movie. The reasons I do hit play on this movie are why I continually do it time and time and time again. Because this is, I mean, this has got to be the most fun Western of all time. Like, just the stuff, Val Kilmer, I will say this. I thought about this and I looked it up and I'll pull up the names. Val Kilmer should have been nominated for an Academy Award. It's amazing. Like, you look at it and you think it's cheesy and you think, he's giving a fantastic performance. He's working his ass off.
Well, and put his body through
yes.
a ton to get as skinny and, I mean, he was not physically well because of what he put his body through to get into this role. And that's one of the interesting things with it is there are decent performances in and around this, but in the midst of this, you know, action Western, which I think did deliver on what it tried to be.
Yes.
You had an exceptional acting performance that just, like, popped in there.
So, Best Supporting Actor this year, what he would have gone up against. He didn't even get nominated, but he would have gone up against Leonardo DiCaprio in What's Eating Gilbert Grape, his, you know, kind of what put him on the map. Ralph Fiennes, Schindler's List. Okay. John Malkovich in The Line of Fire. Pete Postlewaite in The Name of the Father, which is a movie I've never seen. But then Tommy Lee Jones won for The Fugitive. Now, I'm not going to throw shade at Leo or Ralph Fiennes. But if you're telling me, and I love Tommy Lee Jones in a movie, and I love In the Line of Fire, I will watch any crappy thriller that Clint Eastwood put out in the 90s. There's no way that that's better than what Val Kilmer did. There's no shot.
Yeah, it seems like if there was ever going to be a year that a movie like A Tombstone yes. could end up with an Academy Award winning performance, that category's fairly open. And
yeah, I mean, you talk about, like, in 2000, Robert Downey Jr., let's not forget, I mean, you guys have cast shade at this movie. I think it's one of the best comedies ever made. Robert Downey Jr. in his life was nominated for Tropic Thunder, right? Like, there's a precedent for not high art movies getting nominated if something's just quite good enough. Mm-hmm. And like we said with why do we love The Rock so much, what takes it to that next level? It's because Ed Harris is really freaking good in it, and I mm-hmm. think he should have been nominated. What takes this from, there was a movie that came out the very next year. Kevin Costner's Wyatt Earp movie came out in 1994. Mm-hmm. I've seen part of it once, and I really don't care to ever see the whole entire thing of it. And I've already said I love Westerns. Why does Tombstone stand out, and why is Tombstone great? It's some mustaches, and it's Val Kilmer. I mean, he is the driving force.
Yeah, I was going to say to you, like, you know, it could have been worse, right? It could have been, you said, oh, we could have cut out all these other parts. Well, you could have also added in a lot more, and then you end up with Costner's Wyatt Earp. And the difference is, in Wyatt Earp, they tried to make Wyatt Earp the protagonist that he wasn't in real life.
Right.
Whereas in this movie, they kind of delivered on who he was.
You seem confused by my Val Kilmer love.
Yeah, I was kind of replaying the scenes in my head. This was one of the more recent of the five that I watched for the podcast, so it's pretty fresh in my mind. And like, I give props to what Mike was saying about what he had to put his body through. And, you know, when someone does that, it's like obviously committed to the craft. He deserves some credit for that. But like, I guess I don't know what about that performance was that earth shattering or that amazing. Like, he played a cool guy who played cards and drank and, you know, could cough and be sweaty and carry himself through that. Like, it was different than all the other parts in the film. So he stood out. I like the character. I like the part. I think he did great. But to say Academy Award, like, when I think of what should get an Academy Award, like, you're going to show all of that plus range, plus, you know, outside of the box of what that person could be, and you really make it a memorable thing. Like, it's memorable because he's sick and it's different and he did it fine. Like, but I guess I'm just surprised that you think it was worthy of knocking off some of those other performances.
I think supporting actor is where you're allowed to get a little squirrely with what gets nominated. Like, in my opinion, I think lead actor should always just be performances that bring a tear to your eye or, like, kind of, like, emotionally move you. I think supporting actor is where you're allowed to kind of have a little fun. Like, I mean, I joked about Robert Downey Jr. getting nominated for Tropic Thunder. I think it was warranted. I mean, like, if you've seen Tropic Thunder, very offensive movie, sure, but he's a Australian actor playing someone who's pretending to be an African American. Like, it doesn't move me emotionally, but it's pretty impressive, and it elevates the movie, in my opinion, because he commits to how outrageous it is. This, everybody in this movie is the straight man. Everybody in this movie is trying to be very serious, and he, just by product of how they make this character, I have no idea if Doc Holliday was this outlandish in real life, but he chews it up. Mm-hmm. And the scene, when he is on screen, I think it makes this movie so much better. It's almost like an MVP award. Like, if Val Kilmer didn't play Doc Holliday the way that he did, and that character was as serious as the rest of the characters, I don't think I've seen, I would have watched this movie 20 plus times. Like, he, to me, the first scene that he's in with Kurt Russell, even the first scene that he's in, but like, the way he's talking to fat Billy Bob Thornton, and, you know, the way he shrugs him off but brings him back, like, just the way that whenever he steps on screen, he's just moving everybody around him. He's not even a supporting character. He just becomes the lead actor just because of how charismatic he is. And I think that deserves the credit that he didn't get.
To me, it's similar to, like, if you were to give Damian Lillard the MVP in the NBA, like, he carries his team. He's better than everybody else out there. He's a great player in the NBA, and the performances he gives night in and night out are fantastic. But I don't think, you know, if you put him up against the top five players in the NBA, he's going to fall short. You know, and I think that's where I would equate Val Kilmer to in this, is like, he wins the film. He does a great job. And he stands out because, you, like you said, everybody's trying to play the straight guy and all of this, and he doesn't. So, again, superstar, you know, if I can go with the Dame Lillard thing, superstar NBA player, but not an MVP performance, in my opinion. Like, again, it's nitpicky, and your statement is an opinion, so I can't tell you you're wrong, but I just, I'd have a hard time giving him that much credit. To say that he was robbed by not getting, I mean, he definitely deserved maybe a nomination or a little wink and a nod, like you like to say. Yeah. But
I think the other side of it too is what he would have gone up against this year. I think if this would have been a more like powerhouse year, like we just got done talking about Three Billboards, right, where you got Woody Harrelson and Sam Rockwell getting nominated, going up against Tommy Lee Jones. Again, I love Tommy Lee Jones, mm-hmm. but I mean, you're talking about like an emotionally evoking some emotion, moving something, like really making you feel something. The Fugitive's awesome, but like,
yeah,
does Tommy Lee really change anything in that movie? And Malkovich, I don't know if you've seen In the Line of Fire, if either of you've seen that.
It's been a while, yeah.
He's on screen for 5 minutes. It's mostly a phone call. Like, so that's where I'm saying, like, and like you said, this is the perfect year that something like this could have gotten at least the nomination of, like, buddy, you brought it. Like, that's impressive. Good job. Like, that's where I would be at with it. Mm-hmm. But there are other people in this movie, a whole host of other people. Kurt Russell, I think the only time we've ever talked about Kurt Russell is with Miracle.
Yes, I think that is correct.
I can't remember any other time that we would have talked about him. Kurt Russell is someone, and I think I said this back then, if you asked me, I would say I'm a big fan of Kurt Russell, but then I look through his filmography and I realize I haven't watched that much Kurt Russell, and I think it just comes down to Miracle, and this, like, is why I'm willing to say I'm a big fan of his. But he carries this movie well, and I think the biggest fact, the little factoid I would bring, this film is credited as being directed by George P. Costamos. Kurt Russell directed this movie. Is basically, if you read anything about this movie, if you understand anything that went on, Kurt Russell did direct this film. More times than not, anything I've ever read about it is basically he would show up on set each day. It was an absolute shit show, and Russell would know, we need to be here and here and here. That's where the camera's going. Let's go. So I think that is also pretty impressive that he basically directed this film when he wasn't supposed to because of the craziness that was going on.
Yeah, a similar era, a couple years after this. I also liked him in Executive Decision. Fantastic. You know, but again, that is like bad 90s action almost at its peak. It's not quite to The Rock level, but like it's right in that cut right below. And so yeah, I think Russell, but again, great performance here for what it was supposed to be, and particularly when you add in the parts of him essentially directing it while also being the lead actor. Yeah, not bad at all.
The only one I think you missed was Backdraft. He was in that one.
Oh, yep. Okay. There you go. That. Another one. See, I can never just name Kurt Russell movies, but again, any movie that we mention, I really enjoy. I love Executive Decision. Loved Backdraft. I think he's a good time.
Yeah.
You said that you gave the fist pump for Sam Elliott, as any red-blooded American man should, when Sam Elliott walks on screen. I think that's the biggest thing. So I said, I think it was during the Avatar episode, that I think we have five movies this month that had a goal and knocked it out of the park. Absolutely did it. I'm not saying these movies are perfect, that they're, you know, the highest art of all time, that they're the greatest piece of cinema that's ever hit screen. But I think this is another example of what was this movie trying to be? A 90s action western. And you have to have certain people playing certain roles. So when you look at... I'm blanking on who plays Curly Bill. Powers Booth. So Powers Booth and Michael Biehn. I mean, come on. How could you have gotten two better bad guy performances if you're ranking this as a 90s action movie? They're so good. They're so terrible as people, but they're so good. And then you get Sam Elliott being Sam Elliott. You get Paxton. I mean, it's everybody just does what they're supposed to do.
Stephen Lang, Glenn, I mean, just does an incredible job with that role for, again, what this was trying to be, which was an action western that was set in the period of time, but was a little bit more active than westerns that had come before it.
So if you're going to take Val Kilmer out of it, who besides him was the MVP of the movie?
Well, I think what they should have done is when Bill Paxton is sitting there and he sees that, he mentions that storm about to come through, if he had gotten in his red truck and chased it, that would have added a little bit to this film.
Crossover event?
Yes, a little. And then Philip Seymour Hoffman comes on screen and yells something about the extreme. Definitely would have loved that. But, I think for me it's got to be Kurt Russell as far as next best performance, and I think that's simply just by, you know, how important he was to this film and how much screen time he has. But definitely a lot of standout performances, but probably Michael Biehn would be the one that I'd mention, just because, like, he played the most legit, like, scary bad guy in this one. Like, you just realize how unhinged he is, but also smart and talented. And you know, when Doc Holliday goes out there to have that showdown with him, you're like, you know, pretty fearful that, like, okay, are they biting off more than they can chew here? And it was definitely more one-sided than I expected, and Doc Holliday takes him down. But, like, yeah, I think that those two performances probably win it for me.
I think they do a great job of making sure that, you know, there's no way Kurt Russell would have beat him. Just by everybody's reaction to it. Like, there's 0% chance that Wyatt would have been able to win that fight. And I think they do a really good job of that. Because even when they drag Michael Rucker's body back and he challenges him and he says that he'll be there, the other two guys are like, what? You're actually going to go fight this dude? So I think they do a really good job of that. And I remember being pretty shocked. I do remember, like, as a kid, whenever the first time I watched this was, and it is... Doc Holliday that shows up to the fight, I remember, like, giving a little fist pump, like, oh, this is pretty cool. I'm pretty excited that this is now him. Like, I think they do a really good job of that. I think, I mean, they just do a lot of really good, it's action tropes, sure. I mean, I think, too, where does this movie drag a little bit? We have the montage of them killing the cowboys, then he kills Michael Biehn. We're gonna do another montage of killing cowboys. Right? Like, that it does drag a little bit after that, but we still get a great line, too, of, you know, the last ride of Wyatt Earp and his immortals. Like, that's pretty fantastic. It's just, I don't know, it's just a lot of guys, like, just chewing up scenery, but it's like The Rock. Like, I can't get enough of it. I really enjoy it. I mean, I think Thomas Hayden Church even pops up in this. The guy from Lost pops up in this. I never know his real name. Terry O'Quinn?
Yeah, Terry O'Quinn. Charlton Heston.
Yes.
Jason Priestley.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean...
Yeah, I mean, it's
everybody. I said Fat Billy Bob Thornton. Great scene.
Oh, yeah.
Is it my favorite scene? Let's find out. Let's get into it. Do you guys want to do favorite line, favorite scene?
Did you mention Michael Rooker, too? I mean,
I did. I said they dragged his dead body back through the field. Yeah, I think they're all great.
And did I read this right? Harry Carey Jr.?
Not sure if it's the same.
Sure, might as well.
Because he played Fred White, right? And yeah. So, like, I think...
Yeah, that's not...
I think he would have actually been older. Unless Harry Carey, the Cubs announcer, happened to be the third. Yeah, who knows? Maybe it was actually Harry Carey.
It could have been.
Hi, kid.
What would have made this movie better?
Back here with Wyatt.
That would have done it. Let's do favorite scene first, because I want to say favorite line. Favorite scene from Tombstone. If you're allowed to pick one.
Well, I'm just sitting here frozen in fear of trying to pick one line. I think my favorite scene, and man, this would vary from time to time, but I'm just going to go with the one that popped into my head right now. And it is the scene where Ringo comes out drunk and, you know, stumbles out and he's threatening everything. And Holiday is there, you know, about to get a shave and then pops down and starts talking with him, you know, and then eventually just goes back and just leans back, you know, Barber, you may proceed, sir.
Say when. Because that's the one that I like. That is a great scene. And it like. Because he's not going to make it a fair fight. He's got his gun behind him, ready to go. Like, the other dude's drunk.
Yep.
He's already got the drop on him, but he's just does not... He doesn't care about being a gentleman.
Just a great job. Powers Booth comes in, tackles him. Yeah. And don't mind him. He's just drunk, Saul.
Yeah. That's great. So, Brad, your favorite scene?
It's probably when he's spinning the cup on his finger.
Yeah.
When, you know... I don't remember the cowboy name, but Bean... pulls the gun on him and does that whole thing and gets everyone's attention. Then he stands up and you're like, and back then, this is like when someone's going to die, right? Yeah. Like someone's going to get pissed off that they got showed up. He's going to pull a gun. He's going to kill the guy. And luckily, Doc was so over the top with it that it broke the tension and everyone just kind of went back to their what they were doing before. But that one always stands out as one of my favorite scenes.
He's educated. I definitely hate him. Uh-huh. See, everything he says. I mean, it's got to be the gunfight at the OK Corral. That's always been like that. I mean, it's just so... Because that's what this is all... I mean, all of the legend of Wyatt Earp is because of this, right? Like, we would not be sitting here talking about Wyatt Earp if all he was a lawman from Kansas.
Right.
This legend has been built because of the gunfight at the OK Corral, and nobody knows exactly what happened, but everybody knows that something happened, and... Which version are we getting? I mean, there's got to be at least 10, 12 movies that show the gunfight at the OK Corral, and all of them are in a different way.
Yeah.
But the way that they do this one, you know, starting with Doc walking in and, you know, someone else had to tell me that they're coming for us, and this we're not going to go down. We are going to go down there, and then walking that long walk through town all the way to that. And then the best part about Tombstone is their version of the gunfight at the OK Corral insinuates that it all happened because Doc Holliday decided to wink at someone just to piss him off one more time. And that, I mean, and it's a great scene too. It's a great way to play out. I mean, if you're talking, I mean, it's eight guys in, you know, how a very small area, and how are we going to make this entertaining for a few people just shooting at each other, going in, Ike, you know, running through, that whole thing. I think they did that actually really, really well for this being like kind of a bad action movie. That's a really well done scene, building up that tension, the look on all their faces, all that stuff. So it's the gunfight. Mike, you have the script pulled up.
Like, I'll just read through line by line. Yeah, I mean, what I will say, I had the chance to go to Tombstone. I just showed a picture of me at the Birdcage Theater, which is still standing. And it is kind of cool to go back and see.
Still on the roof? Or?
Well, I didn't look that close. But to go back and see, you know, and see where this part of the country was. Again, I think what makes Westerns appeal to so many, right, is that you're just going back into history a little bit. It's a time where there was all the promise of, you know, striking it rich and independent, being out on your own. So favorite lines. I mean, this movie is insanely quotable. One thing it definitely got right was the dialogue. It is witty. It is fast.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you got to go with the Doc Holliday line. And so for me, I'm going to just go with this one because it's, I think, a great line. He is at the end of a long bender and just very simply says, I have not yet begun to defile myself. And so that is my favorite line of this movie tonight. There are so, so many more, but I have not yet begun to defile myself.
I'm going to pass because I don't know that there was any line that really stood out, nor could I do any of them justice.
Asking Ike to a spelling contest is high up on the list.
That's a great one.
And one I always forget about. I mean, my favorite one that I always remember first and I always think about is right after Powers Booth kills Harry Carey Jr., apparently. And they're all standing around. And Thomas Hayden Church says, he's so drunk, he's probably seeing double. And his response of, I have two guns, one for each of you. That
the both of you, right?
Yeah, the both of
the
you.
The both of you, yeah.
So, but that is my favorite Doc Holliday moment and line. And, yeah, I mean, hey, Mike and I had a hell of a good time watching this.
Yep, and I will every other time that I watch it. I think, this year, right? Schindler's List. Is this movie Schindler's List? Of course not. But I tell you what, I would much rather rewatch this movie than Schindler's List. And so there's a difference between exceptional cinema and movies that deliver on what they are supposed to, which is to get you to keep watching.
Can I make a confession right here?
You've never seen Schindler's
List.
Cheated on Rotten Tomatoes.
you made that confession earlier in the month. Never seen Schindler's List.
I've never seen Schindler's List. I mean, at this point in my life, there's never just a day where I'm like, you know what? I'd like to check that one off the list.
Yeah,
like,
but you also at the same time think, I'm going to watch Red Eye again rather than...
You'd rather watch Schindler's List than Red Eye.
If I had never seen Schindler's List, I would definitely watch it before watching Red Eye a 30th time.
I know it like 12 Years a Slave. You guys seen that one?
Yeah.
I've seen it once. Right. I never want to go through that again.
But you saw it once.
But I don't know if I even wanted to see it that one time. That anyway, whole different conversation. Maybe we can watch Schindler's List next year. It's probably a December movie, right? Something like that. No, we'll see. Anyways, that was Tombstone, Mike's pick for the month of August. Next week we're going to get into, we can call it a group pick. It's basically, what? August, December, wherever we're at.
Whew! Hey, you know what? We've been doing this podcast for a while, and the months are literally flying by.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, next week we're doing the impossible. That's what I was just starting to think ahead of what we're doing.
Ethan shows up to work tomorrow and is presented with a drug screen, you'll know that they aren't random.
Very true.
August.
Yeah, we're going to get a little more emotional. That's what it was. I was just already preparing myself for next week as we talk about the impossible. Kind of a group pick, kind of my second pick for the month of December. But we'll get into that. So much more next week. Thanks to everybody for supporting the show. And other than that, guys, for Mike, for Brad, I'm Ethan, and we'll see you next time.